Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Living Proof's dry shampoo is so good at actually cleaning your hair that you can do hot yoga and not wash your hair after. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Squarespace, providing tools that help people showcase their passions with a customized landing page, website, or online store. Also offering domains, hosting, and 24/7 support. Get your free trial at squarespace.com/modernlove. You should. Squarespace.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Becoming a parent can be one of life's most rewarding experiences, but also one of the most challenging, full of curveballs and some very tough decisions. For Elizabeth Fitzsimons, the challenges began before she even brought her daughter home. Here's Connie Britton, best known for playing Tammy Taylor in NBC's Friday Night Lights and Raina James in ABC's Nashville, reading Elizabeth's essay, My First Lesson in Motherhood.
I saw the scar the first time I changed Natalie's diaper, just an hour after the orphanage director handed her to me in a hotel banquet room in Nanchang, a provincial capital in southeastern China. Despite the high heat and humidity, her caretakers had dressed her in two layers, and when I peeled back her sweaty clothes, I found the worst diaper rash I'd ever seen, and a 2-inch scar at the base of her spine, cutting through the red bumps and peeling skin. The next day, when the Chinese government would complete the adoption, was also Natalie's first birthday. We had a party for her that night, attended by families we'd met and representatives of the adoption agency, and Natalie licked cake frosting from my finger. But we worried about a rattle in her chest, and there was the scar. So afterward, my husband Matt asked our adoption agency to send the doctor. We had other concerns, too. Natalie was thin and pale and couldn't sit up or hold a bottle. She had only two teeth, barely any hair, and wouldn't smile. But I had anticipated such things. My sister and two brothers were adopted from Nicaragua, the boys as infants. And when they came home, they were smelly, scabies-covered diarrhea machines who could barely hold their heads up. Yet those problems soon disappeared. I believed Natalie would be fine, too. There was clearly a light on behind those dark eyes. She rested her head against my chest in the baby carrier and would stare up at my face, her lips parting as she leaned back, as if she knew she was now safe. She would be our first child. We had set our hearts on adopting a baby girl from China years before, when I was reporting a newspaper story about a local mayor's return home with her new Chinese daughter. Adopting would come later, we thought, after I became pregnant. But I didn't become pregnant, and after 2 years of trying, I was tired of feeling hopeless, of trudging down this path, not knowing how it would end. I did know, however, how adopting would end, with a baby. So we'd go to China first, and then we'd try to have a biological child. We embarked on a process lasting months of preparing our application and opening our life to scrutiny, until one day we had a picture of our daughter on our refrigerator. 14 months after deciding to adopt, we were in China. And now we were in a hotel room with a Chinese doctor, an older man who spoke broken English. After listening to Natalie's chest, he said she had bronchitis. Then he turned her over and looked at the scar. Frowning, he asked for a cotton swab and soap. He coated an end in soap and probed her sphincter, which he then said was loose. He suspected she'd had a tumor removed and wondered aloud if she had spina bifida before finally saying that she would need to be seen at the hospital. Two taxis took us all there, and as we waited to hear news, I tried to think positive thoughts of the room we had painted for Natalie in light yellow and the crib with Winnie the Pooh sheets. But my mind shifted when I saw one of the women from the agency in a heated exchange in Chinese with the doctors, then with someone on her cell phone. We pleaded with her for information. A CT scan confirmed that there had been a tumor that someone, somewhere, had removed. It had been a sloppy job. Nerves were damaged, and as Natalie grew, her condition would worsen, eventually leaving her paralyzed from the waist down. Control over her bladder and bowels would go too. Yes, she had a form of spina bifida, as well as a cyst on her spine. I looked at my husband in shock, waiting for him to tell me that I had misunderstood everything. But he only shook his head. I held on to him and cried into his chest, angry that creating a family seemed so impossible for us, and that life had already been so difficult for Natalie. Back at the hotel, we hounded the women from the agency. Why wasn't this in her medical report? How could a scar that size not be noticed? It was 2 inches long, for God's sake. They shook their heads, shrugged, apologized. And then they offered a way to make it better. In cases like these, we can make a rematch with another baby, the one in charge said. The rest of the process would be expedited and we would go home on schedule. We would simply leave with a different girl. Months before, we had been presented with forms asking which disabilities would be acceptable in a prospective adoptee. What, in other words, did we think we could handle? HIV? Hepatitis? Blindness? We checked off a few mild problems that we knew could be swiftly corrected with proper medical care. As Matt had written on our application, this will be our first child, and we feel we would need more experience to handle anything more serious. Now, we faced surgeries, wheelchairs, colostomy bags. I envisioned our home in San Diego with ramps leading to the doors. I saw our lives as being utterly devoted to her care. How would we ever manage? Yet how could we leave her? Had I given birth to a child with these conditions, I wouldn't have left her in the hospital. Though a friend would later say, well, that's different, it wasn't to me. I pictured myself boarding the plane with some faceless replacement child and then explaining to friends and family that she wasn't Natalie, that we had left Natalie in China because she was too damaged, that the deal had been a healthy baby and she wasn't. How could I face myself? How could I ever forget? I would always wonder what happened to Natalie. I knew this was my test. My life's worth distilled into a moment. I was shaking my head no before they finished explaining. We didn't want another baby, I told them. We wanted our baby, the one sleeping right over there. She's our daughter, I said. We love her. Yet we had a long, fraught night ahead, wondering how we would possibly cope. I called my mother in tears and told her the news. There was a long pause. Oh, honey. I sobbed. She waited until I caught my breath. It would be okay if you came home without her. Why are you saying that? I just want to absolve you. What do you want to do? I want to take my baby and get out of here, I said. Good, my mother said. Then that's what you should do. In the morning, bleary-eyed and aching, we decided we would be happy with our decision. And we did feel happy. We told ourselves that excellent medical care might mitigate some of her worst afflictions. It was the best we could hope for. But within 2 days of returning to San Diego, before we had even been able to take her to the pediatrician, things took another alarming turn. While eating dinner in her high chair, Natalie had a seizure. Her head fell forward, then snapped back. Her eyes rolled and her legs and arms shot out ramrod straight. I pulled her from the high chair, handed her to Matt, and called 911. When the paramedics arrived, Natalie was alert and stable, but then she suffered a second seizure in the emergency room. We told the doctors what we had learned in China, and they ordered a CT scan of her brain. Hours later, one of the emergency room doctors pulled up a chair and said gravely, "You must know something is wrong with her brain, right?" We stared at her. Something was wrong with her brain, too? In addition to everything else? "Well," she told us, "Natalie's brain is atrophic." I fished into my purse for a pen as she compared Natalie's condition to Down syndrome, saying that a loving home can make all the difference. It was clear, she added, that we had that kind of home. She left us, and I cradled Natalie, who was knocked out from seizure medicine. Her mouth was open, and I leaned down, breathing in her sweet breath that smelled like soy formula. Would we ever be able to speak to each other? Would she tell me her secrets? Laugh with me? Whatever the case, I would love her, and she would know it. And that would have to be good enough. I thanked God we hadn't left her. She was admitted to the hospital, where we spent a fitful night at her bedside. In the morning, the chief of neurosurgery came in. When we asked him for news, he said, "It's easier if I show you." In the radiology department screening room, pointing at the CT scan, he told us the emergency room doctor had erred. Natalie's brain wasn't atrophic. She was weak and had fallen behind developmentally, but she had hand-eye coordination and had watched him intently as he examined her. He'd need an MRI for a better diagnosis. We asked him to take images of Natalie's spine, too. He returned with more remarkable news. The MRI ruled out the brain syndromes he was worried about. And nothing was wrong with Natalie's spine. She did not have spina bifida. She would not become paralyzed. He couldn't believe anyone could make such a diagnosis from the poor quality of the Chinese CT film. He conceded there probably had been a tumor, and that would need to be monitored. But she might be fine. The next year would tell. There would be other scares, more seizures, and much physical therapy to teach her to sit, crawl, and walk. She took her first steps one day on the beach at 21 months, her belly full of fish tacos. Now she's nearly 3, with thick brown hair, gleaming teeth, and twinkling eyes. She takes swimming lessons, goes to daycare, and insists on wearing flowered sandals to dance. I say to her, "Oh, Natalie," and she answers, "Oh, Mama." And I blink back happy tears. Sometimes when I'm rocking her to sleep, I lean down and breathe in her breath, which now smells of bubblegum toothpaste and the dinner I cooked for her while she sat in her high chair singing to the dog. And I'm amazed that this little girl is mine. It's tempting to think that our decision was validated by the fact that everything turned out okay. But for me, that's not the point. Our decision was right because she was our daughter, and we loved her. We would not have chosen the burdens we anticipated, but we are stronger than we thought.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Connie Britton, reading Elizabeth Fitzsimons' essay, My First Lesson in Motherhood. We'll hear how Natalie's doing today after the break.
Support for Modern Love, the podcast, comes from Living Proof, the science behind healthy hair.
I'm Katie from Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. Dear Living Proof, I just want to say thank you for creating the perfect hair day line. I teach several fitness classes a week, and now I can go from shampooing once a day to once a week. I feel silly being so obsessed with hair care products, but they are truly magical. Love, Corey Lynn. Use the code LOVE for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order, livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript from Modern Love editor Daniel Jones and the author of this week's essay, Elizabeth Fitzsimons.
Natalie is 11. She's going to be 12 in May. She's in sixth grade. She works hard in school. She's earnest and completely guileless. She's sweet, and she's just a lovely young person. For a while, when she was little, she still had to take physical therapy and occupational therapy to sort of reach all of the milestones that she was behind on. And it was my goal for her to be caught up with her peers by the time that she was in first grade. And she was. She's totally in line with her peers now. She's strong and healthy. She's just tough as an ox. The scar on her back remains a mystery to this day. Her surgeon, her theory was that Natalie was born with a teratoma that was growing from the base of her spine. And a teratoma is a benign tumor, just a growth. And the surgeon believes that someone removed it, and that's where the scar came from. Every year around her birthday, her surgeon would take a blood test and check the area to make sure that nothing was growing back. And by the time she was about 5 or 6, her surgeon cleared her and said, I think she's good to go. This is not an issue anymore. And we haven't really looked back since.
This essay had a big impact on me. It's something that I've thought about in all the years since. It's the kind of essay where we heard very moving emails from a lot of readers that were devastating. In many cases, readers who'd made the opposite choice. And we also heard from people who had made the same choice that Elizabeth and her husband made, but did end up taking care of children who had physical problems, psychological problems. They weren't in a position to say, we wish we hadn't done this, but they were clearly suffering under the weight of what they'd taken on. So it just led to a real outpouring.
The whole experience, it really changed what I thought was a big deal and what I thought was important and what I really became grateful for. I mean, the mornings in our house can get pretty hectic, and Natalie will invariably come into my bathroom with 10 minutes left to lift off, and she has her rubber band and a hairbrush and she wants some complicated hairstyle. My first thought is like, seriously, Natalie? And then I go to remembering that when she was a baby and so much was unknown ahead of us, that I used to fantasize about brushing her long brown hair as soon as she grew some hair. It was something I just yearned for, and just to be an ordinary mother and daughter. And now I get that every morning, and it's just a gift. You just learn to appreciate those little things so much more.
So last year, I was speaking at a book event in Cleveland, and during the Q&A, someone asked, what is love? And despite the fact that I've edited this column for 11 years and I've written a book called Love Illuminated, I always squirm when someone asks me that question. It seems like too big of a question. And I told him and told this group of people the story that Elizabeth tells in my first lesson in motherhood. And that, to me, is the best definition of love that I can think of. It's a bond you feel and a caretaking and responsibility and not walking away when things not only get tough but so dire that it seems like this lifelong sentence. You know, what a choice. I can't imagine that anyone who hears or reads this essay doesn't put themselves in Elizabeth's shoes.
Elizabeth has since remarried, but she and her first husband, Matt, continue to co-parent Natalie. And a few years ago, Elizabeth gave birth to twin boys. But she says adoption was the best way for her to start her journey as a parent.
Well, I'm still a big fan of adoption. It didn't turn me off of adoption. I think that, if anything, it showed me that life is unpredictable and messy, and whether you're adopting or you're having your kids biologically. I mean, I had a very scary pregnancy with my boys that ended at 33 weeks with an emergency C-section. And you never know what's going to happen. But I think adoption is a wonderful way to have your family. Everyone I know who's adopted, they just can't imagine being without that child, that somehow that there's some kind of magical connection there.
Elizabeth Fitzsimons, author of My First Lesson in Motherhood. Now, Elizabeth has sent us some pictures of her family, and you can see them at wbur.org/modernlove. And we also just heard from Modern Love editor Dan Jones. By the way, there's someone else who wanted to weigh in on Elizabeth's piece, Connie Britton herself.
Quite simply, once I finished reading it, I was like, "That I have to read that." I mean, there's no question. This is the one I have to read. This is an issue very near and dear to my heart. I have a son adopted from Ethiopia. Thankfully, I did not have to go through these kinds of issues, but I really have a very profound understanding of the complexities and the depth of love involved in adopting. And it's a difficult and scary process leading up to bringing that child home. And I just think it's a beautiful story and such a personal story.
Special thanks to Connie for reading Elizabeth's story for us. She most recently appeared in the FX series The People vs. O.J. Simpson, and you can see her now in ABC's Nashville. Next week on Modern Love, Joshua Jackson, best known for his role on the Showtime series The Affair. You might also know him as Pacey Witter from the 90s hit Dawson's Creek. He reads a story about life and love after 26 months in an Iranian prison.
Jenny and I became more serious, though love still didn't quite make sense to me. Ours wasn't at all like the relationships I was used to with my cellmate, the prison guards, or the interrogators. I didn't have to commit to a hunger strike or bang on the cell door to be heard, and this new way of interacting was welcome, but more complicated.
And we always want to know what you think of this episode or any other episode of Modern Love you've heard, so subscribe on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a review. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM and the Go License Collection at ghostlysongs.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.